Honorable Chief Justice David Gilderson presiding is now in session.
Please be seated. Good morning. The first case for oral argument is the State of South Dakota Appellant versus Mark and Marilyn Long and others, appellees. For the appellant state, we have Mr. Gary Timpson and Mr. Joel Engel, attorneys from Sioux Falls. And I understand, Mr. Timpson, you'll be presenting this morning.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. For the appellees, we have Mr. Mark Meyer-Henry and Mr. Christopher Healy. And Mr. Meyer-Henry, I understand you'll be presenting this for us.
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Justice Wilbur has disqualified herself in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Mark Barnett, a judge from the Sixth Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Wilbur's place. With that, Mr. Timpson, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices. Counsel, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here, as always. So little time, so much law and facts. I intend to address all of the elements in our brief as time and questions allow. As far as items of specificity, flow volumes, things like that are better found in the brief and referred to there as opposed to oral argument. State of South Dakota in Minnehaha and Lincoln County in 1949 constructed that segment here involved of Highway 11, which runs from Minnehaha County to Lincoln County in a north-south direction on the eastern edge of both of those counties. It's a two-lane hard surface highway, as I said, constructed in 1949. At that time, Sioux Falls had a population of about 55,000 people, and Lincoln County was a largely rural area. As the city grew southward toward 57th Street, which is the Lincoln County, Minnehaha County line, and southward, of course, urbanization increased along that area. In about the late 70s and early 80s, people in the Elmond area, or what's known as Schindler, that is the plaintiffs in this case, began constructing homesteads along the western edge of Highway 11 south in the Lincoln County area.
So at the time the road was constructed in 1949, there's no residences out there?
That's correct.
Is that uncontested?
I believe that's uncontested, with the exception of maybe some scattered farmsteads. Nothing adjacent to, so far as I know, either side of the roadway. There was a little community of Schindler, but that's farther south and on the east side of the road and unaffected to anything in this area. So we have Highway 11, constructed in 1949 and structurally virtually unchanged until July 29, 2010, the date of the flood incident, which gives rise to the incident case. The highway in all that time, in 61 years, had never flooded. That whole area where the plaintiffs are, that's uncontested, had not flooded due to the roadway in 61 years. Again, the highway hadn't changed structurally in all that time. What had changed were certain other factors around it, the main of which would be the urbanization of the city of Sioux Falls, which was originally a party defendant in this case, and which is a cross-claim, the object of our cross-claim for contribution and or indemnity, which I'll address in a little bit, in this case. In 1990, the city hired the Stockwell Engineering Company to do a study as to what effect urbanization up to, but not exceeding 57th Street would have on downstream flow in the Spring Creek tributary area, which originates up, I believe, about 49th Street and what we would call Sycamore Avenue in the city of Sioux Falls. Again, 49, that was all agricultural land. The Rockwell study said that it's going to vastly increase the flow downstream because of urbanization, which increases the area, the flat area of impervious sites, such as rooftops, streets, sidewalks, driveways, parking lots, etc. That doesn't absorb water, it allows it to run down. What should be done, Rockwell said, was there should be construction of detention ponds in the 57th Street area. That was not done by the year 2010. I think the court can notice, but urbanization since 1990 has proceeded far south of 57th Street in southeastern Sioux Falls. The plaintiffs in this case hired their expert witness, a Mark Minnelli from Lincoln, Nebraska, to testify as to the effects of urbanization. His report was introduced and received at trial as a part of the record on appeal.
And what did you have an expert on that point?
Pardon me?
Did you have an expert on urbanization?
No, we did not. I was satisfied with Mr. Minnelli's testimony on that point. And again, his report talks about the specificity of flows. I think the critical point is he said if, in fact, detention pond 7.4 had been constructed by the city, as indicated in the Stockwell 1990 plan and in a subsequent engineering study, that downstream flows would have been reduced to pre-urbanization levels, i.e. no flooding for 61 years. That was not done. And so we being the state of South Dakota, filed a cross-claim over the objection of the plaintiffs against the city of Sioux Falls for contribution or indemnity, which cross-claim Judge Rypel allowed. And we proceeded on that basis and asked for, and I think the judge ruled in our favor, that it be treated in a tort-like manner for two reasons. One, our position is this is really not a takings case in the first instance, but a negligence case. More on that later. But second of all, it's a very unique case, one of first impression for this court, and I think for most courts. We were able to find only one case and reported in the country, and it's referenced in our brief, Warner Electrica Atlantic Corporation versus County of DuPage, and an Illinois appellate court decision that says, no, inverse condemnation is not a tort, but where you have two condemning authorities, which was the initial posture of this case, and again, the DuPage County case was the only one we could find, meaning Mr. Engel, also addressed the issue of two taking authorities. And the analysis in that case is where you have two taking authorities, you treat it like a tort case. Contribution or indemnity, you have an apportionment and an offset. So going forward, first, early on in this case, the state made a motion for summary judgment. The case at that time had been assigned to Judge Larry Long. Judge Long heard the case and denied it on the basis that this constituted a taking and not a design defect case against the state of South Dakota. We petitioned for, but were not granted a discretionary appeal in that at that stage of the case. I think it's not a taking for this reason. I submit to the court that one incident that occurs in 61 years with no change, no structural change in Highway 11, in any way relevant to this case, in a year in which, as Dr. Dennis Toddy, South Dakota State climatologist, a professor and doctorate in climatology at SDSU University, testified without any contrary testimony, was one, the wettest year in the history of South Dakota since statehood, and also that on the evening of January 29, morning of January 30, 2010, that area where the plaintiffs live in northeastern Lincoln County was experienced to a catastrophic or subject to a catastrophic rainfall event.
Mr. Timpson.
Judge Barnett.
When the DOT went in and resurfaced in 2010, did they do anything to change the amount of drainage that would be available to that area?
No. They did make one minor adjustment from the original correction, but that would actually increase the drainage, and that was they reset the original Twin 48 reinforced concrete pipes a slight bit lower, and that enhances rather than impedes flow across the highway. But other than that,
did the plaintiff claim that DOT reduced the drainage in 2010?
I don't think they claimed so much that they reduced the drainage in 2010, but that the DOT should have taken better steps to increase downstream drainage east of Highway 11. And that the and Judge Rypel found that the Twin 48 RCP pipes were inadequate to handle certain rainfall events. Although the Drake report and Chad Hanisch, who is the state's expert engineer, Clark Engineering, that was also an engineering firm commissioned by the city of Sioux Falls to study drainage in the Spring Creek tributary area, both said that the Twin 48-inch pipes complied with the design standards and would handle a 50-year flood event.
All right. There was references to an 8-year event and to a 50-year event and to a 100-year event. Do they make any difference? Because we're talking about the highway blocking drainage along the Spring Creek tributary, and that the natural drainage flow, whether or not the highway is there, does it make any difference how many year event it is?
I think it doesn't, because I mean, I think if the court upholds the decision in this case, you make any township, county, state, municipality, or the state of South Dakota who constructs a roadway an absolute insurer, because at some point you can have a precipitation event that can overcome any drainage mechanism in place. The terminology is what it is. It's kind of unfortunate. In other words, you know, when we talk about hurricanes, we have a Category 1, a Category 2, which talks about level and intensity. I think, again, we're stuck scientifically, at least with the terminology. But an 8-year flood doesn't mean it's going to occur every 8 years. It means there's an X percent chance. You know, obviously you could have 200-year flood events back-to-back and not have one for 300 years. But be that as it may, Dr. Toddy testified, uncontroverted, that this was the wettest year up to that time since statehood, and that there was a catastrophic rain event. He did some very sophisticated models, not only showing the intensity of rainfall incidents at various random spots as measured by Coco Ross observers, but using radar parabola, and that's his phrase because I don't know what it means, he could also determine the frequency and intensity of rainfall. For example, we all know if you get a 1-inch rainfall over a 24-hour period, it's probably going to make the corn grow. If you get 1-inch rainfall over a 30-minute period, it's probably going to flood things. And that's what happened here. We had this rain that just deluged. Judge Rypel says, now, nah, you can't use Toddy's testimony at all because he didn't have any sites actually situate in Lincoln County. So the only one is the National Weather Service at the Sioux Falls Airport, which, newsflash, is not in Lincoln County either, and is 7 miles away from this incident. He had it mapped out very well, these Coco Ross observation points. Coco Ross, and that's an acronym that I can't explain to you now without reference, are volunteers that are signed up and trained by the National Weather Service. They're given rain gauges and told how to use them, where to place them, and they report on a daily basis. It all goes to the National Weather Service headquarters in Colorado. These things are used scientifically. And obviously, a Coco Ross observer today could be on vacation. One might be sick. That's why there are numerous, and you kind of, I'll use the term average, those devices. But going back to the outset, I think Judge Long made a mistake. I think Judge Long, first of all, should have granted our motion for summary judgment in this case, because I don't see, and I haven't seen authority, that one instance of flooding in 61 years involving an unchanged structure, that being Highway 11, occasioned by a catastrophic rainfall in the wettest year in history constitutes a, quote, taking.
You're saying there's really no factual dispute here. You're just saying as a matter of law, you're not liable. Is that?
Well, I think that's right, unless you're going to make it strictly liable, because the state statutes grant immunity to the state and the DOT for defects, alleged defects, in the design, construction, or maintenance of roadways. Well, and Judge Rypel found, hey, this flooded because your twin 48s weren't big enough. That's
well, you
a
don't. You take issue with Judge Rypel not letting your evidence in, but then you're telling me we don't need a retrial because we should win on the legal merits. Is that correct? Am I understanding what you're saying?
I think that's the first issue. That's the way I think the result ought to be. Although Judge Rypel, it wasn't an issue of not letting the evidence in. Dr. Toddy testified. She just said in her written findings of fact that that it was not of little value or something to that effect, that she gave it very little weight.
How do you distinguish Rupert, in which we abrogated the defense of sovereign immunity for inverse condemnation claims?
On the issue, Justice Kern, of consequential damages. This court first said in the Creer versus Del Rapids Township case and reiterated in Rupert that it has to be consequential damages. Those two cases are different. The county or the township paved a road or covered a road in gravel rather than asphalt, and the plaintiff's career said, hey, you have vastly increased the amount of dust and things that are plaguing our property, and that's compensable. It constitutes a taking. The Supreme Court said, no, it doesn't. Anybody who lives by a gravel road is subject to having a dust problem, and therefore your damages or your alleged damages are not different in kind, but only in degree, and therefore that's not a taking and it's not compensable. Fast forward to Rupert. City of Rapid City is putting down a chemical de-icer on a roadway. And as it melts and washes off, it invades the plaintiff's property. And again, there they had consequential damages because there was a chemical effluviant that went on and killed trees, shrubbery, and foliage on their property. That is consequential damages. In other words, you live by a gravel road, you might have dust, and everybody might have dust. On the other hand, you live by a public street, or in this case, a highway, anybody can have flooding. That's not consequential, but you had this chemical damage, this effluvium, and that established the element of consequential damages, which since Creer, this court has said is essential to prove a taking. In this case, there are no consequential damages. Anybody who lives next to a roadway at some juncture may experience flooding. The plaintiffs in this case had flooding that was different in degree but not in kind from that common to any person constructing a home, abutting, a roadway. Virtually all roadways are elevated, Judge Barnett.
When the plaintiffs were trying their case, what did they tell the judge that the DOT should have done in 2010 that they didn't do? Are they basically saying they should have put in bigger culverts?
Yes. Prior to 2010, they're saying you should put in bigger culverts, and there could have been work done downstream on the east side of the highway that would have received the water faster. That, for a couple of reasons, is not a persuasive argument. Number one, as I said, both the Mr. Hanisch, the state's independent expert, and Clark Engineering, who were retained by the City of Sioux Falls, said that the Twin 48 RCP pipes were, in fact, adequate. Second, the state can't just go in and start going downstream and dredging and digging channels and doing that sort of thing. One, SDCL 46A-10A, sections 13, 16, and 71, but generally that whole chapter says that the DOT's not only responsibility, but authority to do anything ends at the highway right-of-way. The downstream and adjacent area watersheds are the subject of municipalities, counties, and local governments. So, number one, 61 years, this thing hadn't flooded. Number two, both the city's engineers, Drake and our engineers, are saying the Twin 48s are adequate for a 50-year event, which exceeds the design standards, and three, we have no authority to go do those things. So the state is looking and saying, you know, we've had this highway for 61 years. These people in the 70s and 80s started building homes. We've never had a bit of a problem. We have no control over what the city does about the recommended detention ponds. We have no control about how far south 257th and ultimately across Sioux Falls is now in the 96th, 99th streets in some areas, that urbanization might go. And so to address the Chief Justice's last question, yes, I think where Judge Long said and ultimately Judge Rypel said these Twin 48s are the problem, they weren't big enough, that's a design defect, and that you have a situation where one incident in 61 years does not constitute a taking, especially when that one incident is accompanied by the catastrophic precipitation preceding and during the event in question.
Mr. Timpson, let me ask you about your
Justice Zinner,
your contribution indemnity claim. I'm struggling figuring out from the record whether you or why you didn't or why you're claiming that you didn't have an opportunity to put on evidence against the city for contribution indemnity. Why? What happened as far as proof on that?
I think essentially that we had, they called Mark Minnelli, and Mark Minnelli's report went into evidence. And Mark Minnelli was retained and did his report when the city of Sioux Falls was still a party defendant. And his report is replete with the evidence of contribution of urbanization by the city of Sioux Falls and how it contributed to the downstream flooding, to the point of even saying, listen, if you'd have built that pond that Stockwell said, pond 7.4, the downstream flow would have been the same as pre-urbanization levels. But I think the evidence is there, regardless of who introduced it, Justice.
But you're asking for, as an alternative, you're asking for a remand to try that issue. And why would there need to be a trial on that issue then?
Because I think it was error for the court in its findings and conclusions. Judge, see, we have a bifurcated trial here. At the instruction of Rupert, we had, was there or was there not a taking is a legal issue for the court, and that included the issues of liability. Was there a taking by the city and so forth? That was an issue tried to the court, and that was addressed by her findings of fact and conclusions of law. The only issues for the jury phase of the trial was the taking permanent or temporary and the amount of damages, if any, sustained by the landowners. So I think it should go back because I think it's error on the part of Judge Rypel in the light of Minnelli's uncontroverted testimony about the contribution of urbanization to say it didn't matter and there was no evidence when, in fact, there was evidence, and it was evidence produced by the plaintiff's expert.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Okay, thank you very much, Your Honors.
Mr. Meyer Henry, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel. The state's raised four issues in this case. The first issue is they want immunity. I think the Rupert case and 115 years of this court's decisions take care of that issue. This is an inverse condemnation case. It involves drainage. The next issue is the one just raised by Judge Zinner, which is the contribution. As a matter of procedure, this was not pled until the plaintiff settled with the city. Upon settling with the city, suddenly the state, and we had a trial date, we were ready to go to trial, got a delay to file a cross-claim. As Rupert instructed, this court instructed, inverse condemnation, trespass, and negligence are no longer put together. So the plaintiffs, having read your decision, said that we must dismiss the trespass claim and the negligence claim, and that was agreed to by the state. Those were dismissed out. The plaintiffs objected to the use of the Joint Tortfeasors Act, because if you read the Joint Tortfeasors Act, it only applies to torts. Be that as it may, and we didn't appeal that issue, we think the judge was wrong to do that, but we're not appealing that issue, the judge allowed the state to prove their case, if they had one, against the city for contribution. The state attempted to do so. They failed.
At what point in the trial did the state try to prove that?
During the liability phase, Your Honor. If you look at the findings of fact and conclusions of law, and frankly what the state's doing is re-arguing their case here today, the findings of fact are clear on that point. If you go to the findings of fact, and of course none of these are mentioned in their brief as being clearly erroneous, the court found in finding of fact 68 through 72 that they failed to prove their case. So in the liabilities section, the trial judge ruled there was no liability on the part of the city. Now we go to the damages trial. Mr. Timpson appears to think that he should still get another crack, even though there is no liability, for him to make the same argument he's been making from the beginning, that somehow the city is at fault.
You lost me when you were talking about you think the court was wrong in their ruling on contribution, and I...
Let me back up. Let me make that clear. Contribution has to do with joint liability and so forth. It is a tort theory. The Joint Tortfeasors Act covers torts.
Okay.
This is an inverse condemnation case, Judge.
So you're saying that there isn't any contribution because this isn't a tort.
Exactly. It shouldn't apply. I argued that to Judge Rypel. She, don't fall for this, allowed, I do legally, but not practically as a trial judge trying to run a trial when the state out of the blue comes up with a new theory of a cross-claim that they sat on for 4 years, by the way, And so that's what adds this confusion. But to answer that question, it doesn't make any difference unless you retry the case and come up with different factual findings than the trial court. You don't get the contribution.
Now, Mr. Timpson alluded to a case that dealt with contribution. I think it was Warner.
Yes.
Is there any theory on which does that case stand for the proposition that you can have contribution if there's no tort?
That's a fun case to read, and I've read it two or three times. I think that was the frustration of a trial court trying to bring a case to conclusion. If you read the facts of that case, really unusual. It is, I agree with the state, the only case of that nature in the country.
Well, wasn't there a negligence claim appended to the inverse condemnation claim in Warner?
There was. And, I mean, it's just one of those outliers. But if you read the history of that, you know, there's numerous issues there that are not here. I mean, the facts of this case are not that confusing. I mean, they really aren't when you get down to it. I want to get back to just this, though. The trial court found, as to their third issue, that they're entitled to contribution, there was no liability. So if there's no liability on the part of the city, there can't be any contribution.
What would you even get there? I mean, sovereign immunity has to be expressly waived by the legislature. Now, you've got a Joint Tortfeasors Act, but is there an express waiver in there of the state's sovereign immunity? That's, to me, as simple as the question gets.
But now I go back to what this court ruled in Rupert. We don't have tort claims attached to inverse condemnation claims.
Right.
And by the way, Mr. Timpson, his argument keeps talking about a taking. This isn't a takings case. This is a damaging case. There's a difference, big difference. This is a damaging case like Rupert.
So on damaging, then, if we get another one of these floods next summer, the state's not off the hook. They're going to be writing another check every time they get a rainstorm, right?
No.
Okay, why not?
Because they did it the way they're supposed to. They've repaired it. This all goes back to a simple thing. This is a matter of hydraulics. It's the water on the ground. It isn't the rainfall. Judge Rappel got it. And this argument the state's making to you is the same one they did to the trial court. Mark Minnelli was the only one who opined as to the cause. By the way,
well, what about his comment, counsel's comment, that we basically have ticking time bombs all over the state waiting to go off when we have some kind of a natural disaster where the county or the township or the city didn't foresee that damage when they did the road work 70 years ago? Are they now an insurer?
Well, that's... that's a big statement, and the answer is obviously no. First of all, it's wait for that case. That isn't this case, number one.
I kind of think it is, because this is precedent setting.
Well, precedent setting, of course. I guess we can all agree that I think in the 45 years I've been a lawyer, there's been four inverse condemnation cases before your honors. And what's precedent setting here is this. In 2008, there was a study that every government knew. That study said the Spring Creek tributary, which is what we're talking about here, has a peak flow of 803 cubic feet. The state knew that when they repaired this road. That peak flow is what's called the 100-year flood. And the 100-year flood is what the design is toward. This was nothing close to that, Your Honor.
Mr. Meyer-Henry, didn't your clients build into the risk? In other words, when they go in there and they know there's 48s, I know that assumption of risk is not the legal issue here, but it seems to me that they built in that area knowing or should have known, might have known, that there was a drainage problem. And when the 2008 study comes along and says, indeed, the twin 48s are not enough, are you saying then that the state had an active duty to go out and modify at that time?
Well, the law of this state has been towards the government. It's in our brief, all the decisions. But to remind Your Honor, the decisions have been that the government has to follow the drainage law like private individuals. That if you build structures and so forth that destroy the natural drainage, liability attaches.
But when did they build a structure that damaged or that caused this problem? Was that in 49 or in 2000?
Could have. But let's get back to what caused the damage here. There's two 48-inch culverts, all right, that are woefully inadequate in the year 2010 when this flood happened.
And weren't they inadequate, though, when your clients built there?
No. Mr. Timpson makes a big point. It didn't flood for 61 years. Time goes on.
I mean, the state has a duty to go back out there statewide.
I don't know, because that's not this case. If you will look at Exhibit 16, Exhibit 16 is a hydrologic report and survey they do, the state does, each time they do a bridge or a culvert. In 2010, they did such a study. The study told them that if there's an 8-year rain event, in other words, a 12.5% probability each and every year, if there's rain, these culverts, these two 48-inchers, will back up water and it will go over the driveway to the south. When it goes over those driveways, Your Honor, they now have a little culvert, which is in a sub-basin where my client's houses are located. That has a drainage of 40 CFS maximum, okay? And that's important because here we had 275, not 803, this massive pie-in-the-sky rain that the state talks about. We had an 8-year event. It overtopped the testimony.
Mr. Meyerhan, we're on the internet. Could you kind
I'm
of
sorry.
Hang around the podium?
I apologize. I'm used to the trial court. I apologize. The water goes over these ditch blocks, and it goes into the sub-basin. It put up to 100 CFS of water into this sub-basin that has, in effect, a 2-year event drainage. It drained from one basin into a sub-basin, the water. This resulted from the block-up of the 48-inchers. Since repaired, yes, the problem's gone away.
All right. Mr. Timpson spoke a lot at length about the urban sprawl of Sioux Falls. Do you see that as being relevant as far as a continuing duty of the state to monitor whether the work they did in 1949 is still effective in light of the basically changed drainage patterns from the urban sprawl?
I would think the government, which is all of us, has a duty similar to we privately, that under the drainage law, if we have structures that are backing up water and flooding our neighbors, that we, and we have knowledge of that, we repair them. We fix them. Because otherwise what you're saying is we had a rolling prairie. This case started, the first piece of evidence was the plaintiffs obtained the original survey notes, rolling prairie. Mark Minnelli, the only expert to testify on this, said in its natural condition, these houses would not have flooded even with 100 years. So the natural condition is these houses would not have flooded. They build a road. I can call it a dike. They build a road. They have a duty. I think you would agree we have a duty to put culverts through there. This court is so held in other cases on this very issue. You have a duty to allow the natural drainage to go through. In 2010, the state had that duty to allow the natural drainage. They knew it. As finding of fact 62 states, the trial court found that the state engineer admitted the cause of the flooding was water backed by Highway 11. State admits that. Now, what did that do when it blocked the water? It flooded the sub-basin. Back to the rule of eminent domain is not a few should pay the price for all of us. Because we all know what should have happened. When they read the study, yes, there was urbanization, but part of that is invited by the state. Listen to the state of the state today. I'm sure the governor will talk about growth and progress and things of that nature. This idea that there's all of these ticking time bombs. This court's had 4 inverse condemnations. This is the second one that I've been involved in.
Is the difference in this case that they discovered this in these studies around 2008? Is that because would there be liability if that had not occurred? If the road was just there and there had been no studies, would there be a constitutional damage? that occurred if a flood happened like this one?
Well, each case stands on its own, but this is, to me, Exhibit 16. If this were a tort case, that, you know.
But in a tort case, it's failure to do something you should have done. And it is that so? In this case, is the cause an omission in 2010, or is it the building of the road in 1949?
It's a combination of both. I mean, it's the omission knowing in 2010 that there's a high probability that this will flood land, and a conscious decision, which the court found was a conscious decision by the state that they would flood this land rather than make additional repairs. And so I think it was a combination for the trial court. But the taking and damaging law that I don't think we have to make exceptions for, let's go a case at a time. And yes, it's a precedent, but we're only talking about this case. The clear cause was the state knew that the culverts weren't big enough. They knew they were going to flood these people, or at least statistically, 1 out of 8 years. Unfortunately, it happened within 2 months after they finished their work. And I think that's a big part of this. They anticipated, knew, and almost planned to use this as a pooling mechanism for the drainage, which they were aware of.
Mr. Meyer-Henry, is it fair to say that under your view of this case, you wouldn't argue that the 48s were inadequate when no one was out there, would you? I mean, it's just cropland at that point.
No.
All right. So they became inadequate as the area grew. Is that fair?
I think that's fair.
So is it fair to say then that when the state becomes aware of changing weather patterns or increased runoff from the city or whatever, they would, if you're successful, they would have an affirmative duty to go back out and change the drainage wherever the new conditions suggest that there could be flooding?
I think that's a little bit over expansion because there's some facts you have to fit in there. Right now, they do such hydrologic studies on every bridge and culvert as a routine. But I think when they are flooding land and flooding other people's property, that they would have a duty to do so. Yes. But the duty, the problem that makes everybody start, the duty part of it has been eliminated under Rupert. At least the way I read the Rupert case, it says the elements of this case, did the state take actions that caused the flooding?
Of course, in that case, the trees were there before the de-icer, correct?
Here, well,
the road was there before the homes.
Right.
Does that matter?
I don't think so in this case, because they were well aware that the rebuilding of the road or the replacement of these same culverts were going to cause flooding to other people's land. And that is a cost-benefit.
But when they rebuilt it, they didn't change the amount of flow, did they? They didn't reduce it anyway. They went with twin 48s again.
Right, but they also knew that the maximum flow was 803 cubic feet per second. They knew that's what the flow was, so you would think they would build it to take care of the maximum flow, which is the 100-year standard.
And
that almost everything's built to.
If you're correct, and if the DOT had a duty to put bigger pipes in, what would happen in the case where the downstream, if you will, owners, there's nowhere for that water to go, so by putting bigger pipes in, they're going to flood somebody else. What then is the law?
Well, we don't know that, but it would beg that the political side of the government has a duty to if you're going to promote growth, which we do, that you're going to take care of the drainage and not make a few people pay for the good of all. That this court said that a number of times. The few shouldn't pay for the all.
Yeah. Is it your argument just as simple as the natural flowing, rolling prairie, spring tributary was interfered with all the way back to 1949, and they didn't put in enough culverts to deal with the natural drainage? Isn't it that simple?
It's that simple, really. And the mechanics of how it isn't just the 48s. That's not what caused it. It's the fact, it's even worse than that, they diverted it from the 48s that were inadequate over here to this sub-basin that only had a two-year culvert. And so it's even more egregious, at least from the proof. The other thing I do want to urge with all seriousness is that we had a trial. We had findings of fact and conclusions of law. These arguments and questions that are being asked don't overwhelm the findings of the trial judge. The trial judge in this case worked hard at this. I mean, the state produced no expert that supports what they said. I could go through all these factual things that were argued here today, but Judge Rappel did that, and she reduced it to writing, which they have, you know, I still stand by my objection to their brief. They've never noted to your honors or me which findings of fact are clearly erroneous.
So you're saying basically the state is liable or they're not, and if they're liable, the judge's decision stands.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the first part of your question.
You're saying that either the state is liable or it's not liable, and if they are liable, the judge's decision stands as to damages. That there's no question on the damages. Either they're liable for the amount the judge said they were liable for, or they're not.
Well, I don't think they've appealed the amount of the damages. They've appealed that they didn't get to claim contribution from the city. I think that's where they're at.
Okay. Thank you. Your time has expired. Yep. Mr. Timpson, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
And I'll try to be brief. I think I'd like to go back and readdress Justice Zitter's question. Here we have the question of whether or not we have are entitled to contribution or indemnity from the city. Obviously, we filed a cross-claim. The plaintiffs objected, the judge ruled. They haven't appealed the fact whether it was 3 years later or 2 years later or a month later. That issue was decided by the judge, and it's not before this court on appeal. Our issue was, here, look at Manelli's report. We don't need an expert if their guy is saying what we believe. Urbanization was a substantial factor, and he talks about the flows and what the city could have, knew they should have done, and would have reduced the downstream effluvium to pre-urbanization levels.
But where can you point to me in the code the state has unequivocally abrogated sovereign immunity to allow contribution? And it can't be implied. Our case law says it's got to be express.
It's the, we would be seeking contribution against the city.
Right, but it could go both ways.
Well, as a joint tortfeasor. So how are you going to get around Rupert sovereign immunity? I mean, that's the crux of it.
I guess I don't know. I've never seen a case where they have. This is a unique case where we have this issue of two condemning or taking authorities, if you will, in theory. I think the answer to that is you have the right of contribution or offset. You can't claim against the state, so you show or apportion its liability and then claim that as an offset against the other tortfeasor's liability. So you don't have a claim against the city. You don't breach sovereign immunity because you just take the offset. And that's one of the issues in our case is the amount of settlement by the city should, at a minimum, be offset in any judgment against the state. You know, I've always been kind of a get-it-done kind of guy, and I don't like to reinvent the wheel or do over. A good example is in this very case. When we had a real estate appraiser we hired, we disclosed, we'd done the reports and everything, but when it got down to the posture of the case, and Brian Schmidt, their real estate expert, testified, we're saying, that's right in the ballpark with our values. There's no sense to bring in another expert to say what's already in evidence. We don't disagree. And that's where we were with the Manelli report. You know, inverse condemnation, if I can do an analogy, if I built in 1949 a house, you know, half a mile off the end of the runway in the airport, and I lived there for all those years, and then all of a sudden I find out they've invented the jet engine, and now jets are flying off that thing, there's a change there, but that doesn't mean that the condemning authority or the taking authority has now condemned my property. I built in an area next to a structure, an airport in that case, and next to a highway in this case. Mr. Meyer Henry says, well, no, you know, that's not going to be make road builders of any governmental absolute insurers or impose strict liability. This case isn't precedent. If this case isn't precedent, West Publishing goes out of business. There's a whole you know, Northwest Reporter Series, every decision this court makes is precedent.
But isn't it addressing the issue of the road? Doesn't the road interferes with the natural drainage, does it not?
I think the road per se, but I think the interference is accommodated by the twin 48-inch pipes, as proven by 61 consecutive years of adequate drainage. Also, Mr. Meyer Henry likes to continue to refer to this 8-year event, and that and the state did have expert witnesses, DOT personnel, that would tell you there's a difference. You measure between a dynamic and a static flow model.
All right, but if it was rolling prairie without the road, it wouldn't have backed up the water.
Presumably that's true.
So isn't that the issue?
Well, if it were rolling prairie, then I guess if we never construct a railroad or a highway, we don't have an issue. But I don't think that's the world in which we live. And so when a railroad is constructed...
Yeah, but I think that's the law under which we're dealing.
Well, Your Honor, I think the law is that if we construct highways, and we have tens of thousands of miles of them in this state, that where you do otherwise obstruct with the rolling prairie flow, you accommodate for that with structures. And the size and placement of those structures is determined by hydrological studies and and rainfall prediction events, none of which are going to be 100% accurate. But the Clark study and Mr. Hanisch both said this complied with a 50-year model. We exceeded that. And so I think you have undisputed evidence by the plaintiff's own expert that urbanization vastly increased the downstream flow into this area, and that's what overloaded it. There was a plan in place drawn by the city that would have ameliorated that, again, according to Mr. Minnelli, the plaintiff's expert, and it wasn't put in place. I don't think the state of South Dakota has the authority to go around to the city and say, hey, wait a minute, you guys, you know, you want to build a strip mall here? You better check with us. We have the authority to do that. I think Judge Barnett hit the nail on the head. You know, if we or Lincoln County had gone down on the east side of the highway, somebody, you know, or we put in these big pipes without telling anybody, we just moved the lawsuit across the road. I mean, then we would be dumping unnatural amounts of water, and that's what some of the other decisions of this court have talked about. There's not an unnatural amount of water dumped on this property because Highway 11 is there and because there are 48-inch pipes. There was an unnatural amount of water dumped and accumulated on this property because Sioux Falls had urbanized drastically from the time this roadway was built in 1949, and because this occurred during a record rainfall year and a catastrophic precipitation event. And that, as I said, I believe does not constitute a taking. Justice Curran asked the question about Rupert. We don't have consequential damages present in this case.
Can I ask you a question about the final issue in your brief regarding your claim that you own a drainage easement? Is that still an argument that you're submitting?
Yes, I think so. If the court should find that, yeah, there was a taking, and we have paid, it's a permanent taking.
It's damaging. And it's a damaging case, constitutional damaging case, and your argument is that you own a drainage easement?
If they say we have permanently damaged their property, and we pay them for that permanent damage, then Mr. Meyer Henry concedes we don't go back time after time. I guess the only thing is that we have that prescriptive easement to allow that water flow and accumulation across that area.
You didn't file eminent domain proceedings to take the property.
No, that was not done.
Would that be necessary?
I don't think so in an inverse condemnation case, Justice Kern, but I don't know of case authority one way or the other on that point.
One last time on contribution and indemnity. If we did remand this, what kind of proof would you put on, and do you contend that that should be presented to a judge or to a jury?
I think it should be presented to a jury because that would be part of the compensation question. The evidence put on would be the testimony or the report of Mr. Minnelli or perhaps another expert of similar qualification and training, a hydrologist.
Isn't it a question of causation, not damages?
Well, I think it's a question of causation, but if you have two causative factors, as the plaintiffs initially complained, city, your pipes are too small, or pardon me, state, your pipes are too small. City, you built too far down without doing your detention ponds and allowing more water to go forth in a southerly direction. If you're going to proceed with that, and again, I think that's first impression with this court, and I think both sides concede one impression throughout the United States we know of, where you have two taking or damaging authorities, do the plaintiffs get to recover twice? I think that's clearly not the case. That's beyond damages, restoring them to their pre-injury or pre-damage condition.
Is there an issue yet with the contribution law? I mean, I don't, you're claiming, you're talking about it, but Judge Rypel ruled on it, and I'm not sure if she was right or not, but is that still an issue in this case of what the law is?
I think it is, because once we got to the damage, the monetary issue, even though she ruled, yep, state, you can have your cross-claim against the city, and yes, we're going to treat this as the Warner case indicates. Once we get to the jury phase to figure out dollars, we're not allowed to present any testimony to say, look, because she's saying, I know your claim is against the city, and if you could prove something, you have the right to contribution, but as far as I'm concerned, Mr. Minnelli's uncontroverted testimony notwithstanding, you haven't enough evidence to take that issue to a jury, and we thought we did.
So if she's wrong on the contribution issue, you could lose because there isn't any law allowing contribution.
You mean if she's wrong on the contribution issue, but I think equitably the court can look and still say, you know, here's an offset. A person is not entitled to any more damages than would reasonably compensate them for the loss, and if they've recovered one place, I think at the very least there's an offset, which also then avoids the waiver of immunity question.
And was that argued to the trial court?
I believe so. I don't have the transcript in front of me.
Your time has expired.
It is. Thank you very much, Your Honor, for your consideration.
Mr. Meyer-Henry, there was a question during the rebuttal on the easement. You obviously didn't have a chance to speak to that. I'll give you 1 minute if you wish to talk about the easement issue in fairness.
Thank you. My 1 minute is simply this. This asks for a transfer of real property. The state never filed a pleading. Never got a resolution of necessity from the Department of Transportation, which is necessary to start an eminent domain case. Never filed any pleadings, never gave any notice, and we still don't know today what the easement's supposed to say. I think it's just should be dismissed out of hand because there's no procedure. They never pled it. There's a lot of times when I've lost a case, I'd like to say, oh, by the way, could I get something? And I don't know what else to say. There's no support for it.
And so you've told the court that the state went in and fixed the culverts. That's outside the record. But
yeah, that's true. I probably shouldn't have said it. So
obviously you've told us the drainage has been resolved. But yet they're asking for a drainage easement to permanently flood the property?
Well, yes and no, Judge. I mean, it has now been resolved, and in answer to many of these questions, worried about setting a precedent, I got a lot more to say about that. But just to cut it off, yes, these are works that are constantly in progress. I mean, anybody who goes to Sioux Falls knows it's not standing still. It's not 1949 again.
Okay. Thank you for your
minute. Can I follow up with one question on that?
All right. You didn't get off.
Take it out of my other
long minute.
Next case.
So what happens if the new pipes aren't big enough in a future rain event?
Well, this is what growing societies have to deal with. So you go back to the fundamental rules that are good that this court has set. Number one, you don't have a few citizens pay for the price of progress for many. We're going to be talking about a law that Congress passed because we as a society ran over people to build the interstate highways. All recognize a wonderful project. But here, the base argument is, as to their consequential damages, the record would show Mr. Timpson asked each of my clients, are there a bunch of you that got flooded? No, there's a few people that live in this sub-basin that got flooded because they didn't engineer this correctly. And the state engineers admitted it. They knew it. Now, there's monetary concerns, but we're here arguing about law. And to answer your question, Judge Barnett, yes, but the whole area of Sioux Falls needs drainage attention by the state, the county, the city, and everybody else. And guess what? The state got involved when they got sued.
Okay. Thank you. We'll take a 10-minute recess, and then we'll see you again.
All right.